Chapter 2, Fall 1952. Father had never before hit Abdullah. So when he did, when he whacked the side of his head, just above the ear, hard, suddenly, and with an open palm, tears of surprise sprung to Abdullah's eyes. He quickly blinked them back. "Go home," Father said through gritted teeth. From up ahead, Abdullah heard Pari burst into sobs. Then Father hit him again, harder, and this time across the left cheek. Abdullah's head snapped sideways. His face burned and more tears leaked. His left ear rang. Father stooped down, leaning in so close his dark creased face eclipsed the desert and the mountains and the sky all together. "I told you to go home, boy," he said with a pained look. Abdullah didn't make a sound. He swallowed hard and squinted at his father, blinking into the face, shading his eyes from the sun. From the small red wagon up ahead, Pari cried out his name, her voice high, shaking with apprehension.
"Abdullah!"
Father held him with a cutting look and trudged back to the wagon. From its bed, Pari reached for Abdullah with outstretched hands. Abdullah allowed them a head start. Then he wiped his eyes with the heels of his hands and followed. A little while later, Father threw a rock at him, the way children in Shadbagh would do to Pari's dog, Shuja, except they meant to hit Shuja, to hurt him. Father's rock fell harmlessly a few feet from Abdullah. He waited, and when Father and Pari got moving again, Abdullah tailed them once more. Finally, with the sun just past its peak, Father pulled up again. He turned back in Abdullah's direction, seemed to consider, and motioned with his hand. "You won't give up," he said. From the bed of the wagon, Pari's hand quickly slipped into Abdullah's. She was looking up at him, her eyes liquid, and she was smiling her gap-toothed smile like no bad thing would ever befall her so long as he stood at her side. He closed his fingers around her hands, the way he did each night when he and his little sister slept in their cot, their skulls touching, their legs tangled. "You were supposed to stay home," Father said, "with your mother and Iqbal, like I told you to." Abdullah thought, "She's your wife. My mother, we buried." But he knew to stifle those words before they came up and out. "All right then, come," Father said. "But there won't be any crying, you hear me?"
"Yes."
"I'm warning you, I won't have it."
Pari grinned up at Abdullah, and he looked down at her pale eyes and pink round cheeks and green back. From then on, he walked beside the wagon as it jostled along on the pitted desert floor, holding Pari's hand. They traded furtive happy glances, brother and sister, but said little for fear of souring Father's mood and spoiling their good fortune. For long stretches, they were alone, the three of them, nothing and no one in sight but the deep copper gorges and vast sandstone cliffs. The desert unrolled ahead of them, open and wide, as though it had been created for them and them alone, the air still, blazing hot, the sky high and blue. Rocks shimmered on the cracked floor. The only sounds Abdullah heard were his own breathing and the rhythmic creaking of the wheels as Father pulled the red wagon north. A while later, they stopped to rest in the shadow of a boulder. With a groan, Father dropped the handle to the ground. He winced as he arched his back, his face raised to the sun. "How much longer to Kabul?" Abdullah asked. Father looked down at them. His name was Sabur. He was dark-skinned and had a hard face, angular and bony, nose curved like a desert hawk's beak, eyes set deep in his skull. Father was thin as a reed, but a lifetime of work had made his muscles powerful, tightly wound like rattan strips around the arm of a wicker chair. "Tomorrow afternoon," he said, lifting the cowhide water back to his lips, "if you make good time." He took a long swallow, his Adam's apple rising and dropping.
"Why didn't Uncle Nabi drive us?" Abdullah said. "He has a car."
Father rolled his eyes toward him.
"Then we wouldn't have had to walk all this way."
Father didn't say anything. He took off his soot-stained skull cap and wiped sweat from his brow with the sleeve of his shirt. Pari's finger shot from the wagon.
"Look, Abdullah," she cried excitedly. "Another one."
Abdullah followed her finger, traced it to the spot in the shadow of the boulder where a feather lay, long gray, like charcoal, after it has burned. Abdullah walked over to it and picked it by the stem. He blew the flecks of dust off it. "A falcon," he thought, turning it over. "Maybe a dove, or a desert lark." He had seen a number of those already that day. "No, a falcon." He blew on it again and handed it to Pari, who happily snatched it from him. Back home in Schottbach, Pari kept underneath her pillow an old tin tea box Abdullah had given her. It had a rusty latch, and on the lid was a bearded Indian man wearing a turban and a long red tunic, holding up a steaming cup of tea with both hands. Inside the box were all the feathers that Pari collected. They were her most cherished belongings. Deep green and dense burgundy rooster feathers, a white tail feather from a dove, a sparrow feather dust brown, dotted with dark blotches, and the one of which Pari was proudest, an iridescent green peacock feather with a beautiful large eye at the tip. This last was a gift Abdullah had given her 2 months earlier. He had heard of a boy from another village whose family owned a peacock. One day, when father was digging ditches in a town south of Schottbach, Abdullah walked to this other village, found the boy, and asked him for a feather from the bird. Negotiation ensued, at the end of which Abdullah agreed to trade his shoes for the feather. By the time he returned to Schottbach, peacock feather tucked in the waist of his trousers beneath his shirt. His heels had split open and left bloody smudges on the ground. Thorns and splinters had burrowed into the skin of his soles. Every step sent barbs of pain shooting through his feet. When he arrived home, he found his stepmother Parwana outside the hut, hunched before the tandoor, making the daily naan. He quickly ducked behind the giant oak tree near their home and waited for her to finish. Picking around the trunk, he watched her work, a thick-shouldered woman with long arms, rough-skinned hands and stubby fingers. A woman with a puffed, rounded face who possessed none of the grace of the butterfly she had been named after. Abdullah wished he could love her as he had his own mother. Mother who had bled to death giving birth to Pari 3.5 years earlier when Abdullah was 7. Mother whose face was all but lost to him now. Mother who cupped his head in both palms and held it to her chest and stroked his cheek every night before sleep and sang him a lullaby. "I found the sad little fairy beneath the shade of a paper tree. I know a sad little fairy who was blown away by the wind one night." He wished he could love his new mother in the same way, and perhaps Parvana, he thought, secretly wished the same, that she could love him, the way she did Iqbal, her one-year-old son, whose face she always kissed, whose every cough and sneeze she fretted over, or the way she had loved her first baby, Omar. She had adored him, but he had died of the cold the winter before last. He was 2 weeks old. Parwana and father had barely named him. He was one of 3 babies that brutal winter had taken in Schottbach. Abdullah remembered Parvana clutching Omar's swaddled little corpse, her fits of grief. He remembered the day they buried him up on the hill, a tiny mound on frozen ground, beneath a pewter sky. Mullah Shakib saying the prayers, the wind spraying grits of snow and ice into everyone's eyes. Abdullah suspected Parvana would be furious later to learn that he had traded his only pair of shoes for a peacock feather. Father had labored hard under the sun to pay for them. She would let him have it when she found out. She might even hit him, Abdullah thought. She had struck him a few times before. She had strong, heavy hands from all those years of lifting her invalid sister, Abdullah imagined, and they knew how to swing a broomstick or land a well-aimed slap. But to her credit, Parvana did not seem to derive any satisfaction from hitting him, nor was she incapable of tenderness toward her stepchildren. There was the time she had sewn Pari a silver and green dress from a roll of fabric father had brought from Kabul. The time she had taught Abdullah, with surprising patience, how to crack two eggs simultaneously without breaking the yolks. And the time she had shown them how to twist and turn husks of corn into little dolls, the way she had with her own sister when they were little. She showed them how to fashion dresses for the dolls out of little torn strips of cloth. But these were gestures, Abdullah knew, acts of duty drawn from a well far shallower than the one she reached into for Iqbal. If one night their house caught fire, Abdullah knew without doubt which child Parvana would grab rushing out. She would not think twice. In the end, it came down to a simple thing. They weren't her children, he and Pari. Most people loved their own. It couldn't be helped that he and his sister didn't belong to her. They were another woman's leftovers. He waited for Parvana to take the bread inside, then watched as she re-emerged from the hut, carrying Iqbal on one arm and a load of laundry under the other. He watched her amble in the direction of the stream and waited until she was out of sight before he sneaked into the house, his soles throbbing each time they met the ground. Inside, he sat down and slipped on his old plastic sandals, the only other footwear he owned. Abdullah knew it wasn't a sensible thing he had done, but when he knelt beside Pari, gently shook her awake from a nap, and produced the feather from behind his back like a magician, it was all worth it. Worth it for the way her face broke open with surprise first, then delight, for the way she stamped his cheeks with kisses, for how she cackled when he tickled her chin with the soft end of the feather, and suddenly his feet didn't hurt at all. Father wiped his face with his sleeve once more. They took turns drinking from the water bag. When they were done, father said, "You're tired, boy." "No," Abdullah said, though he was exhausted, and his feet hurt. It wasn't easy crossing a desert in sandals. Father said, "Climb in." In the wagon, Abdullah sat behind Pari, his back against the wooden slat sides, the little knobs of his sister's spine pressing against his belly and chest bone. As father dragged them forward, Abdullah stared at the sky, the mountains, the rows upon rows of closely packed, rounded hills, soft in the distance. He watched his father's back as he pulled them, his head low, his feet kicking up little puffs of red-brown sand. A caravan of Kuchi nomads passed them by, a dusty procession of jingling bells and groaning camels, and a woman with coal-rimmed eyes and hair the color of wheat smiled at Abdullah. Her hair reminded Abdullah of his mother's, and he ached for her all over again, for her gentleness, for her inborn happiness, her bewilderment at people's cruelty. He remembered her hiccuping laughter, and a timid way she sometimes tilted her head. His mother had been delicate, both in stature and nature, a wispy, slim-waisted woman with a puff of hair always spilling from under her scarf. He used to wonder how such a frail little body could house so much joy, so much goodness. It couldn't. It spilled out of her, came pouring out her eyes. Father was different. Father had hardness in him. His eyes looked out on the same world as mother's had and saw only indifference, endless toil. Father's world was unsparing. Nothing good came free, even love. You paid for all things. And if you were poor, suffering was your currency.
Abdullah looked down at the scabby parting in his little sister's hair, at her narrow wrist hanging over the side of the wagon, and he knew that in their mother's dying, something of her had passed to Paddy. Something of her cheerful devotion, her guilelessness, her unabashed hopefulness. Paddy was the only person in the world who would never, could never hurt him. Some days, Abdullah felt she was the only true family he had. The day's color slowly dissolved into gray, and the distant mountain peaks became opaque silhouettes of crouching giants. Earlier in the day, they had passed by several villages, most of them far-flung and dusty just like Shotbok. Small square-shaped homes made of baked mud, sometimes raised into the side of the mountain, sometimes not, ribbons of smoke rising from the roofs. Wash lines, women squatting by cooking fires. A few poplar trees, a few chickens, a handful of cows and goats, and always a musk. The last village they passed sat adjacent to the poppy field, where an old man working the pots waved at them. He shouted something. Abdullah couldn't hear. Father waved back. Paddy said, "Abdullah."
"Yes."
"Do you think Shuja is sad?"
"I think he's fine.
No one will hurt him."
"He's a big dog, Paddy. He can defend himself."
Shuja was a big dog. Father said he must have been a fighting dog at one point because someone had severed his ears and his tail. Whether he could or would defend himself was another matter. When the stray first turned up in Shotbach, kids had hurled rocks at him, poked him with tree branches or rusted bicycle wheel spokes. Shuja never fought back. With time, the village's kids grew tired of tormenting him and left him alone. Though Shuja's demeanor was still cautious, suspicious, as if he had not forgotten their past unkindness toward him. He avoided everyone in Shotbach but Paddy. It was for Paddy that Shuja lost all composure. His love for her was vast and unclouded. She was his universe. In the mornings, when he saw Paddy stepping out of the house, Shuja sprang up. His entire body shivered, the stump of his mutilated tail wagged wildly, and he tap danced like he was treading on hot coal. He pranced happy circles around her. All day the dog shadowed Paddy, sniffing at her heels, and at night, when they parted ways, he lay outside the door, forlorn, waiting for morning.
"Abdullah?"
"Yes?"
"When I grow up, will I live with you?"
Abdullah watched the orange sun dropping low, nudging the horizon.
"If you want, but you won't want to." "Yes, I will." "You will want a house of your own."
"But we can be neighbors."
"Maybe."
"You won't live far."
"What if you get sick of me?"
She jabbed his side with her elbow.
"I wouldn't."
Abdullah grinned to himself.
"All right, fine. You will be close by."
"Yes."
"Until we are old?"
"Very old."
"For always?"
"Yes, for always." From the front of the wagon, she turned to look at him.
Do you promise, Abuelo?
For always and always. Later, Father hoisted Perry up on his back, and Abdullah was in the rear, pulling the empty wagon. As they walked, he fell into a thoughtless trance. He was aware of only the rise and fall of his own knees, of the sweat beads trickling down from the edge of his skull cap, Perry's small feet bouncing against Father's hips, aware only of the shadow of his father and sister lengthening on the gray desert floor, pulling away from him if he slowed down. It was Uncle Nabi who had found this latest job for Father. Uncle Nabi was Parwana's older brother, and so he was really Abdullah's step-uncle. Uncle Nabi was a cook and a chauffeur in Kabul. Once a month, he drove from Kabul to visit them in Shadbagh, his arrival announced by a staccato of honks and the hollering of a horde of village kids who chased the big blue car with the tent top and shiny rims. They slapped the fender and windows until he killed the engine and emerged grinning from the car. Handsome Uncle Nabi, with the long sideburns and wavy black hair combed back from his forehead, dressed in his oversized olive-colored suit with white dress shirt and brown loafers. Everyone came out to see him because he drove a car, though it belonged to his employer, and because he wore a suit and worked in the big city, Kabul. It was on his last visit that Uncle Nabi told Father about the job. The wealthy people he worked for were building an addition to their home, a small guest house in the backyard, complete with bathroom, separate from the main building, and Uncle Nabi had suggested they hire Father, who knew his way around the construction site. He said the job would pay well and take a month to complete, give or take. Father did know his way around the construction site. He had worked in enough of them. As long as Abdullah could remember, Father was out searching for work, knocking on doors for days' labor. He had overheard Father one time tell the village elder, Mullah Shakib, "If I had been born an animal, Mullah Sahib, I swear I would have come out a mule." Sometimes Father took Abdullah along on his jobs. They had picked apples once in a town that was a full day's walk away from Shadbagh. Abdullah remembered his father mounted on the ladder until sundown, his hunched shoulders, the creased back of his neck burning in the sun, the raw skin of his forearms, his thick fingers twisting and turning apples one at a time. They had made bricks for mosque in another town. Father had shown Abdullah how to collect the good soil, the deep, lighter colored stuff. They had sifted the dirt together, added straw, and Father had patiently taught him how to titrate the water so the mixture didn't turn runny. Over the last year, Father had logged stones. He had shoveled dirt, tried his hand at plowing fields. He had worked on a road crew, laying down asphalt. Abdullah knew the father blamed himself for Omar. If he had found more work or better work, he could have bought the baby better winter clothes, heavier blankets, maybe even a proper stove to warm the house. This was what Father thought. He hadn't said a word to Abdullah about Omar since the burial, but Abdullah knew. He remembered seeing Father once, some days after Omar died, standing alone beneath the giant oak tree. The oak towered over everything in Shadbagh and was the oldest living thing in the village. Father said it wouldn't surprise him if it had witnessed the Emperor Babur marching his army to capture Kabul. He said he had spent half his childhood in the shade of its massive crown, or climbing its sweeping boughs. His own father, Abdullah's grandfather, had tied long ropes to one of the thick boughs and suspended a swing, a contraption that had survived countless harsh seasons and the old man himself.
Father said he used to take turns with Parvana and her sister Masuma on this swing when they were all children. But these days, Father was always too exhausted from work when Perry pulled on his sleeve and asked him to make her fly on the swing. Maybe tomorrow, Perry.
Just for a while, Bobo. Please get up.
Not now, another time. She would give up in the end, release his sleeve and walk away resigned. Sometimes Father's narrow face collapsed in on itself as he watched her go. He would roll over in his cot, then pull up the quilt and shut his weary eyes. Abdullah could not picture that Father had once swung on a swing. He could not imagine that Father had once been a boy like him. A boy, carefree, light on his feet, running headlong into the open fields with his playmates. Father, whose hands were scarred, whose face was cross-hashed with deep lines of weariness. Father, who might as well have been born with shovel in hand and mud under his nails. They had to sleep in the desert that night. They ate bread and the last of the boiled potatoes Parvana had packed for them. Father made the fire and set the kettle on the flames for tea. Abdullah lay beside the fire, curled beneath the wool blanket behind Parry. The soles of her cold feet pressed against him. Father bent over the flames and lit the cigarette. Abdullah rolled to his back and Parry adjusted, feeding her cheek into the familiar nook beneath his collarbone. He breathed in the coppery smell of desert dust and looked up at the sky, thick with stars like ice crystals, flashing and flickering. A delicate crescent moon cradled the dim, ghostly outline of its full self. Abdullah thought back to the winter before last. Everything plunged into darkness, the wind coming in around the door, whistling slow and long and loud, and whistling from every little crack in the ceiling. Outside, the village's features obliterated by snow. The nights long and starless, daytime brief, gloomy, the sun rarely out and then only to make a cameo appearance before it vanished. He remembered Umar's labored cries, then his silence. Then Father grimly carving a wooden board with a sickle moon, just like the one above them now. Pounding the board into the hard ground burnt with frost at the head of the small grave. And now autumn's end was in sight once more. Winter was already lurking around the corner, though neither Father nor Parvana spoke about it, as though saying the word might hasten its arrival. Father, he said. From the other side of the fire, Father gave a soft grunt.
Will you allow me to help you? Build the guest house, I mean.
Smoke spiraled up from Father's cigarette. He was staring off into the darkness. Father? Father shifted on the rock where he was seated. I suppose you could help mix mortar, he said.
I don't know how.
I will show you. You will learn.
What about me?
Perry said.
You?
Father said slowly. He took a drag of his cigarette and poked at the fire with a stick. Scattered little sparks went dancing up into the blackness. You'll be in charge of the water. Make sure we never go thirsty, because a man can work if he's thirsty. Perry was quiet.
Father is right, Abdullah said. He sensed Perry wanted to get her hands dirty, climb down into the mud, and that she was disappointed with the task Father had assigned her.
Without you fetching us water, we will never get the guest house built.
Father slid the stick beneath the handle of the tea kettle and lifted it from the fire. He set it aside to cool. I will tell you what, he said. You show me you can handle the water job, and I will find you something else to do.
Perry tilted up her chin and looked at Abdullah. Her face lit up with a gapped smile. He remembered when she was a baby, when she would sleep atop his chest, and he would open his eyes sometimes in the middle of the night and find her grinning silently at him with the same expression.
He was the one raising her. It was true, even though he was still a child himself, 10 years old. When Perry was an infant, it was he she had awakened at night with her squeaks and mothers. He who had walked and bounced her in the dark. He had changed her soiled diapers. He had been the one to give Perry her baths. It wasn't father's job to do. He was a man. And besides, he was always too exhausted from work. And Parwana, already pregnant with Omar, was slow to rouse herself to Perry's needs. She never had the patience or the energy. Thus the care had fallen on Abdullah, but he didn't mind at all. He did it gladly. He loved the fact that he was the one to help with her first step, to gasp at her first uttered word. This was his purpose, he believed, the reason God had made him, so he would be there to take care of Perry when he took away their mother. "Baba," Perry said, "tell a story."
"It's getting late," father said.
"Please?"
Father was a closed-off man by nature. He rarely uttered more than 2 consecutive sentences at any time. But on occasion, for reasons unknown to Abdullah, something in father unlocked, and stories suddenly came spilling out. Sometimes he had Abdullah and Perry sit raptly before him as Parwana banged pots in the kitchen and told them stories his grandmother had passed on to him when he had been a boy, sending him off to lands populated by sultans and jinns and malevolent thieves and wise dervishes. Other times, he made up stories. He made them up on the spot, his tales unmasking a capacity for imagination and dream that always surprised Abdullah. Father never felt more present to Abdullah, more vibrant, revealed, more truthful than when he told his stories, as though the tales were pinholes into his opaque, inscrutable world. But Abdullah could tell from the expression on father's face that there would be no story tonight.
"It's late," father said again. He lifted the kettle with the edge of the shawl draping his shoulders and poured himself a cup of tea. He blew the steam and took a sip, his face glowing orange in the flames. "Time to sleep, long day tomorrow." Abdullah pulled the blanket over their heads. Underneath, he sank into the nape of Perry's neck. "I found the sad little fairy beneath the shade of a paper tree." Perry, already sleeping, sluggishly sang her verse. "I know a sad little fairy who was blown away by the wind one night." Almost instantly, she was snoring. Abdullah awoke later and found father gone. He sat up in a fright. The fire was all but dead. Nothing left of it now but a few crimson speckles of ember. Abdullah's gaze darted left, then right, but his eyes could penetrate nothing in the dark, at once vast and smothering. He felt his face going white, heart sprinting. He cocked his ear, held his breath. "Father," he whispered. Silence. Panic began to mushroom deep in his chest. He sat perfectly still, his body erect and tense, and listened for a long time. He heard nothing. They were alone, he and Perry, the dark closing in around them. They had been abandoned. Father had abandoned them. Abdullah felt the true vastness of the desert and the world for the first time. How easily a person could lose his way in it. No one to help. No one to show the way. Then a worst thought wormed its way into his head. Father was dead. Someone had slit his throat. Bandits. They had killed him, and now they were closing in on him and Perry, taking their time, relishing it, making a game of it.
"Father,"
he called out again, his voice shrilled this time. No reply came.
"Father,"
he called for his father again and again. a claw tightening itself around his windpipe. He lost track of how many times and for how long he called for his father, but no answer came forth from the dark. He pictured faces hidden in the mountains bulging from the earth, watching, grinning down at him and Perry with malice. Panic seized him, shriveled up his innards. He began to shiver and mewl under his breath. He felt himself on the cusp of screaming. Then footsteps, a shape materialized from the dark.
"I thought you had gone,"
Abdullah said shakily. Father sat down by the remains of the fire.
"Where did you go?"
"Go to sleep, boy."
"You wouldn't leave us. You wouldn't do that, Father."
Father looked at him, but in the dark his face dissolved into an expression Abdullah couldn't make out. "You're going to wake your sister."
"Don't leave us."
"That's enough of that now." Abdullah lay down again, his sister clutched tightly in his arms, his heart battering in his throat. Abdullah had never been to Kabul. What he knew about Kabul came from stories Uncle Nabi had told him. He had visited a few smaller towns on jobs with father, but never a real city. And certainly nothing Uncle Nabi had said could have prepared him for the hustle and bustle of the biggest and busiest city of them all. Everywhere he saw traffic lights and tea houses and restaurants and glass-fronted shops with bright multicolored signs. Cars rattling noisily down the crowded streets, hooting, darting narrowly among buses, pedestrians, and bicycles. Horse-drawn gharis jingled up and down boulevards, their iron-rimmed wheels bouncing on the road. The sidewalks he walked with Perry and father were crowded with cigarettes and chewing gum sellers, magazine stands, blacksmiths pounding horseshoes. At intersections, traffic policemen in ill-fitting uniforms blew their whistles and made authoritative gestures that no one seemed to heed. Perry on his lap, Abdullah sat on a sidewalk bench near a butcher's shop, sharing a tin plate of baked beans and cilantro chutney that father had bought them from a street stall.
"Look, Abdullah," Perry said, pointing to the shop across the street. In his window stood a young woman dressed in a beautifully embroidered green dress with small mirrors and beads. She wore a long matching scarf with silver jewelry and deep red trousers. She stood perfectly still, gazing indifferently at passers-by without once blinking. She didn't move so much as a finger as Abdullah and Perry finished their beans, and remained motionless after that too.
Up the block, Abdullah saw a huge poster hanging from the facade of a tall building. It showed a young, pretty Indian woman in a tulip field, standing in a downpour of rain, ducking playfully behind some kind of bungalow. She was grinning shyly, a wet sari hugging her curves. Abdullah wondered if this was what Uncle Nabi had called a cinema, where people went to watch films, and hoped that in the coming month Uncle Nabi would take him and Perry to see a film. He grinned at the thought. It was just after the call to prayer blared from a blue-tiled mosque up the street that Abdullah saw Uncle Nabi pull up to the curb. Uncle Nabi swung out of the driver's side, dressed in his olive suit, his door narrowly missing a young bicycle rider in Japan who swerved just in time. Uncle Nabi hurried around the front of the car and embraced father. When he saw Abdullah and Perry, his face erupted in a big grin. He stooped to be on the same level as them.
"How do you like Kabul, kids?"
"It's very loud," Perry said,
and Uncle Nabi laughed.
"That it is. Come on, climb in. You will see a lot more of it from the car. Wipe your feet before you get in. Sabur, you take the front."
The back seat was cool, hard, and light blue to match the exterior. Abdullah slid across it to the window behind the driver's seat and helped Perry onto his lap.
He noticed the envious way bystanders looked at the car. Paris swiveled her head toward him, and they exchanged a grin. They watched the city stream by as Uncle Nabby drove. He said he would take a longer route so they could see a little of Kabul. He pointed to a ridge called Tepe Marangjan and to the dome-shaped mausoleum atop it, overlooking the city. He said Nader Shah, father of King Zahir Shah, was buried there. He showed them the Balahisar fort atop the Kueshir Darwaza mountain, which he said the British had used during their second war against Afghanistan. "What's that, Uncle Nabi?" Abdullah tapped on the window, pointing to a big rectangular yellow building.
"That silo, it's the new bread factory." Uncle Nabi drove with one hand and craned back to wink at him. "Compliments of our friends, the Russians."
"A factory that makes bread," Abdullah marveled, picturing Parvana back in Shadbagh, slapping slabs of dough against the sides of their mud tandoor. Eventually, Uncle Nabi turned onto a clean, wide street lined with regularly spaced cypress trees. The homes here were elegant and bigger than any Abdullah had ever seen. They were white, yellow, light blue. Most had a couple stories, were surrounded by high walls and closed off by double metal gates. Abdullah spotted several cars, like Uncle Nabi's, parked along the street. Uncle Nabi pulled up to a driveway, decked by a row of neatly trimmed bushes. Beyond the driveway, the white-walled two-story home loomed impossibly large.
"Your house is so big," Parry breathed, eyes rolling wide with wonderment.
Uncle Nabi's head rolled back on his shoulders as he laughed. "That would be something. No, this is my employer's home. You are about to meet them. Be on your best manners now."
The house proved even more impressive once Uncle Nabi led Abdullah, Parry, and Father inside. Abdullah estimated its size big enough to contain at least half the homes in Shadbagh. He felt as though he had stepped into the Deev's palace.
The garden at the far back was beautifully landscaped, with rows of flowers in all colors, neatly trimmed, with knee-high bushes and peppered with fruit trees. Abdullah recognized cherry, apple, apricot, and pomegranate. A roofed porch led into the garden from the house. Uncle Nabi said it was called a veranda and was enclosed by a low railing covered with webs of green vines. On their way to the room where Mr. and Mrs. Wahdati awaited their arrival, Abdullah spied a bathroom with a porcelain toilet Uncle Nabi had told them about, as well as a glittering sink with bronze-colored faucets. Abdullah, who spent hours every week lugging buckets of water from Shadbagh's communal well, marveled at a life where water was just a twist of the hand away. Now they sat on the bulky couch with gold tassels. Abdullah, Parry, and Father. The soft cushions at their backs were dotted with tiny octagonal mirrors. Across from the couch, a single painting took up most of the wall. It showed an elderly stone carver bent over his workbench, pounding a block of stone with a mallet. Pleated burgundy drapes dressed the wide windows that opened onto a balcony with a waist-high iron railing. Everything in the room was polished, free of dust. Abdullah had never in his life been so conscious of his own dirtiness. Uncle Nabi's boss, Mr. Wahdati, sat on a leather chair, arms crossed over his chest. He was looking at them with an expression that was not quite unfriendly but remote, impenetrable. He was taller than Father. Abdullah had seen that as soon as he had stood to greet them. He had narrow shoulders, thin lips, and a high, shiny forehead. He was wearing a white suit, tapered at the waist, with an open-colored green shirt whose cuffs were held together by oval-shaped lapis stones. The whole time he hadn't said more than a dozen words.
Parry was looking down at the plate of cookies on the glass table before them. Abdullah had never imagined such a variety of them existed. Finger-shaped chocolate cookies with swirls of cream. Small round ones with orange filling in the center. Green cookies shaped like leaves. And more.
Would you like one?
Mrs. Watadi said. She was the one doing all the talking.
Go ahead, both of you. I put them out for you.
Abdullah turned to Father for permission, and Parry followed suit. This seemed to charm Mrs. Watadi, who tinted her eyebrows, tilted her head, and smiled. Father nodded lightly.
One each,
he said in a low voice.
Oh, that won't do,
Mrs. Watadi said.
I had Nabi go to the bakery halfway across Kabul for these.
Father flushed, averted his eyes. He was sitting on the edge of the couch, holding his battered skull cap with both hands. He had angled his knees away from Mrs. Watadi and kept his eyes on her husband. Abdullah plucked two cookies and gave one to Parry.
Oh, take another. We don't want Nabi's troubles to go to waste,
Mrs. Watadi said with cheerful reproach. She smiled at Uncle Nabi.
It was no trouble at all, Uncle Nabi said, blushing.
Uncle Nabi was standing near the door, beside a tall wooden cabinet with thick glass doors.
On the shelves inside, Abdullah saw silver-framed photos of Mr. and Mrs. Watadi. There they were, alongside another couple, dressed in thick scarves and heavy coats, a river flowing foamily behind them. In another picture, Mrs. Watadi holding a glass, laughing, her bare arm around the waist of a man who, unthinkably to Abdullah, was not Mr. Watadi. There was a wedding photo as well, he tall and trim in a black suit, she in a flowing white dress, both of them smiling with their mouths closed. Abdullah stole a glance at her thin waist, her small pretty mouth and perfectly arched eyebrows, her pink toenails and matching lipstick. He remembered her now from a couple of years earlier, when Parry was almost two. Uncle Nabi had brought her to Shadbagh because she had said she wanted to meet his family. She had worn a peach dress without sleeves. He remembered the look of astonishment on Father's face and dark sunglasses with thick white rims. She smiled the whole time, asking questions about the village, their lives, asking after the children's names and ages. She acted like she belonged there in the low-ceiling mud house, her back against the wall, black with soot, sitting next to the fly-speck window and the cloudy plastic sheet that separated the main room from the kitchen, where Abdullah and Parry also slept. She had made a show of the visit, insisting on taking off her high-heeled shoes at the door, choosing the floor when Father had sensibly offered her a chair. Like she was one of them. He was only 8 then, but Abdullah had seen through it. What Abdullah remembered most about the visit was how Parwana, who had been pregnant with Iqbal then, had remained a shrouded figure, sitting in the corner in stiff silence, shriveled up into a ball. She had sat with her shoulders gathered, feet tucked beneath her swollen belly, like she was trying to disappear into the wall. Her face was shielded from view with a soiled veil. She held a knotted clump of it under her chin. Abdullah could almost see the shame rising from her like steam, the embarrassment, how small she felt, and he had felt a surprising swell of sympathy for his stepmother. Mrs. Watadi reached for the pack next to the cookie plate and lit herself a cigarette. We took a long detour on the way, and I showed them a little of the city, Uncle Nabi said.
Good, good,
Mrs. Watadi said.
Have you been to Kabul before, Sabur?
Father said, once or twice, Bibi Sahib.
And may I ask, what is your impression?
Father shrugged. It's very crowded.
Yes.
Mr. Watadi picked at the speck of lint on the sleeve of his jacket and looked down at the carpet. Crowded, yes, and at times tiresome as well, his wife said. Father nodded as if he understood. Kabul is an island, really. Some say it's progressive, and that may be true. It's true enough, I suppose, but it's also out of touch with the rest of the country. Father looked down at the skull cap in his hands and blinked.
Don't misunderstand me, she said. I would wholeheartedly support any progressive agenda coming out of the city. God knows this country could use it. Still, the city is sometimes a little too pleased with itself for my taste. I swear, the pomposity in this place.
She sighed. It does grow tiresome. I've always admired the countryside myself. I have a great fondness for it. The distant provinces, the qaryas, the small villages, the real Afghanistan, so to speak.
Father nodded uncertainly.
I may not agree with all or even most of the tribal traditions, but it seems to me that out there people live more authentic lives. They have a sturdiness about them, a refreshing humility, hospitality too, and resilience, a sense of pride. Is that the right word, Suleiman? Pride?
Stop it, Nila, her husband said quietly. A dense silence followed. Abdullah watched Mr. Batati drumming his fingers on the arm of his chair, and his wife, smiling tightly, the pink smudge on the butt end of her cigarette, her feet crossed at the ankles, her elbow resting on the arm of the chair.
Probably not the right word, she said, breaking the silence. Dignity, perhaps.
She smiled, revealing teeth that were straight and white. Abdullah had never seen teeth like these.
That's it, much better. People in the countryside carry a sense of dignity. They wear it, don't they? Like a badge.
I'm being genuine. I see it in you, Sabur.
Thank you, Bibi Sahib, Father muttered, shifting on the couch, still looking down at his skull cap.
Mrs. Wahdati nodded. She turned her gaze to Pari. And may I say you are so lovely.
Pari nudged closer to Abdullah.
Slowly, Mrs. Wahdati recited. Today I have seen the charm, the beauty, the unfathomable grace of the face that I was looking for.
She smiled.
Rumi, have you heard of him? You would think he'd composed it just for you, my dear.
Mrs. Wahdati is an accomplished poet, Uncle Nabi said. Across the room, Mr. Wahdati reached for a cookie, split it in half, and took a small bite.
Nabi is being kind, Mrs. Wahdati said, casting him a warm glance.
Abdullah again caught a flush creeping up Uncle Nabi's cheeks. Mrs. Wahdati crushed her cigarette, giving the butt a series of sharp taps against the ashtray.
Maybe I could take the children somewhere, she said.
Mr. Wahdati let out the breath huffily, slapped both palms against the arms of his chair, and made as if to get up, though he didn't.
I will take them to the bazaar,
Mrs. Wahdati said to Father now.
If that's all right with you, Sabur,
Nabi will drive us.
Suleiman can show you to the worksite out back so you can see it for yourself.
Father nodded. Mr. Wahdati's eyes slowly fell shut. They got up to go. Suddenly, Abdullah wished Father would thank these people for their cookies and tea, take his hand and Paris, and leave this house and its paintings and drapes and overstuffed luxury and comfort. They could refill their water bag, buy bread and a few boiled eggs, and go back the way they had come, back through the desert, the boulders, the hills, Father telling them stories.
They would take turns pulling Pari in the wagon. And in 2, maybe 3 days' time, though there would be dust in their lungs and tiredness in their limbs, they would be back in Shatbagh again. Shuja would see them coming, and he would hurry over, prance circles around Pari. They would be home.
Father said, "Go on, children."
Abdullah took a step forward, meaning to say something. But then Uncle Nabi's thick hand was on his shoulder,
turning him around, Uncle Nebby leading him down the hallway, saying, "Wait till you see the bazaars in this place. You have not seen the likes of it, you two." Mrs. Watati sat in the back seat with them, the air filled with the thick weight of her perfume and something Abdullah didn't recognize. Something sweet, a little pungent. She peppered them with questions as Uncle Nebby drove. Who were their friends? Did they go to school? Questions about their shores, their neighbors, games they played. The sun fell on the right half of her face. Abdullah could see the fuzzy little hairs on her cheek and the faint line below her jaw, where the makeup ended.
"I have a dog," Patty said. "Do you?"
"He's quite the specimen," Uncle Nebby said from the front seat.
"His name is Shuja. He knows when I'm sad."
"Dogs are like that," Mrs. Watati said. "They are better at it than some people I've come across." They drove past a trio of schoolgirls skipping down the sidewalk. They wore black uniforms with white scarves tied under their chins.
"I know what I said earlier, but Kabul isn't that bad."
Mrs. Watati toyed with her necklace absently. She was looking out the window, a heaviness set on her features. "I like it best here at the end of spring, after the rains. The air so clean, that first burst of summer, the way the sun hits the mountains." She smiled wanly. "It will be good to have a child around the house. A little noise for a change. A little life." Abdullah looked at her and sensed something alarming in the woman. Beneath the makeup and the perfume and the appeal for sympathy, something deeply splintered. He found himself thinking of the smoke of Parvana's cooking, the kitchen shelf cluttered with her jars and mismatched plates and smudged pots. He missed the mattress he shared with Perry, though it was dirty, and the jumbles of springs forever threatened to poke through. He missed all of it. He had never before ached so badly for home. Mrs. Watati slumped back into the seat with a sigh, hugging her purse the way a pregnant woman might hold her swollen belly.
Uncle Nebby pulled up to the crowded curbside. Across the street, next to a mosque with soaring minarets, was the bazaar, composed of congested labyrinths of both vaulted and open alleyways. They strolled through corridors of stalls that sold leather coats, rings with colored jewels and stones, spices of all kinds, Uncle Nebby in the rear, Mrs. Watati and the two of them in the lead. Now that they were outside, Mrs. Watati wore a pair of dark glasses that made her face look oddly cat-like. Hagler's calls echoed everywhere. Music blared from virtually every stall. They walked past open-fronted shops selling books, radios, lamps, and silver-colored cooking pots. Abdullah saw a pair of soldiers in dusty boots and dark brown greatcoats, sharing a cigarette, eyeing everyone with bored indifference. They stopped by a shoe stall. Mrs. Watati rummaged through the rows of shoes displayed on boxes. Uncle Nebby wandered over to the next stall, hand clasped behind his back, and gave a down-the-nose look at some old coins.
"How about these?"
Mrs. Watati said to Perry. She was holding up a new pair of yellow sneakers.
"They're so pretty,"
Perry said, looking at the shoes with disbelief.
"Let's try them on."
Mrs. Watati helped Perry slip on the shoes, working the strap and buckle for her. She peered up at Abdullah over her glasses.
"You could use a pair too, I think. I can't believe you walked all the way from your village in those sandals."
Abdullah shook his head and looked away. Down the alleyway, an old man with a ragged beard and two club feet begged passers-by.
"Look, Abdullah."
Perry raised one foot,
than the other. She stomped her feet on the ground, hopped. The Swahdati called Uncle Nabi over and told him to walk Perry down the alley, see how the shoes felt. Uncle Nabi took Perry's hand and led her up the lane. The Swahdati looked down at Abdullah.
"You think I'm a bad person," she said, "the way I spoke earlier."
Abdullah watched Perry and Uncle Nabi pass by the old beggar with club feet. The old man said something to Perry. Perry turned her face up to Uncle Nabi and said something. And Uncle Nabi tossed the old man a coin. Abdullah began to cry soundlessly.
"Oh, you sweet boy," Aswadati said, startled. "You poor darling."
She fetched a handkerchief from her purse and offered it. Abdullah swiped it away.
"Please, don't do it,"
he said, his voice cracking. She hunkered down beside him now, her glasses pushed up on her hair. There was wetness in her eyes too, and when she dabbed at them with the handkerchief, it came away with black smudges.
"I don't blame you if you hate me. It's your right, but... and I don't expect you to understand. Not now. This is for the best. It really is, Abdullah. It's for the best. One day you will see."
Abdullah turned his face up to the sky and wailed just as Perry came skipping back to him. Her eyes dripping with gratitude. Her face shining with happiness. One morning that winter, father fetched his axe and cut down the giant oak tree.
He had Mullah Shakib's son, Baitullah, and a few other men help him.
No one tried to intervene. Abdullah stood alongside other boys and watched the men. The very first thing father did was take down the swing. He climbed the tree and cut the ropes with a knife. Then he and the other men hacked away at the thick trunk until late afternoon, when the old tree finally toppled with a massive groan. Father told Abdullah they needed the firewood for winter, but he had swung his axe at the old tree with violence, with his jaw firmly set and a cloud over his face like he couldn't bear to look at it any longer. Now beneath a stone-colored sky, men were striking at the felled trunk, their noses and cheeks flushed in the cold, their blades echoing hollowly when they hit the wood. Further up the tree, Abdullah snapped small branches of the big ones. The first of the winter snow had fallen 2 days before. Not heavy, not yet, only a promise of things to come. Soon winter would descend on Shadbagh. Winter and its icicles and week-long snow drifts and winds that cracked the skin on the back of hands in a minute flat. For now the white on the ground was scant, pocked from here to the steep hillsides with pale brown blotches of earth. Abdullah gathered an armful of slim branches and carried them to the growing communal pile nearby. He was wearing his new snow boots, gloves, and winter coat. It was second-hand, but other than the broken zipper, which father had fixed, it was as good as new. Padded, dark blue, with orange fur lining inside. It had 4 deep pockets that snapped open and shut, and a quilted hood that tightened around Abdullah's face when he drew its cords. He pushed back the hood from his head now and let out a long, foggy breath. The sun was dropping into the horizon. Abdullah could still make out the old windmill, looming stark and gray over the village's mud walls. Its blades gave a creaky groan whenever nippy gusts blew in from the hills. The windmill was home mainly to blue herons in the summer, but now that winter was here, the herons had gone and the crows had moved in. Every morning Abdullah woke to their squawks and harsh croaks. Something caught his eye, off to his right, on the ground. He walked over to it and knelt down. A feather. Small. Yellow. He took up one glove and picked it up. Tonight they were going to a party. He, his father, and his little half-brother Ekpal. Beitullah had a new infant boy. A motreb would sing for the men, and someone would tap on the tambourine. There would be tea and warm, freshly baked bread, and shorwa soup with potatoes. Afterward, Mullah Sheki would dip his finger in a bowl of sweetened water and let the baby suckle it. He would produce his shiny black stone and his double-edged razor, lift the cloth from the boy's midriff. An ordinary ritual. Life rolling on in Shahdbagh.
Abdullah turned the feather over in his hand.
I won't have any crying, father had said. No crying, I won't have it. And there hadn't been any. No one in the village asked after Paddy. No one even spoke her name. It astonished Abdullah how thoroughly she had vanished from their lives. Only in Shuja did Abdullah find the reflection of his own grief. The dog turned up at their door every day. Parvana threw rocks at him. Father went at him with a stick. But he kept returning. Every night he could be heard whimpering mournfully, and every morning they found him lying by the door, chin on his front paws, blinking up at his assailants with melancholy, unaccusing eyes. This went on for weeks until one morning Abdullah saw him hobbling toward the hills, head hung low. No one in Shahdbagh has seen him since. Abdullah pocketed the yellow feather and began walking toward the windmill. Sometimes, in unguarded moments, he caught father's face clouding over, drawn into confusing shades of emotion. Father looked diminished to him now, stripped of something essential. He loped sluggishly about the house, or else sat in the heat of their big new cast-iron stove, little Akbal on his lap, and stared unseeingly into the flames. His voice dragged now in a way that Abdullah did not remember, as though something weighed on each word he spoke. He shrank into long silences, his face closed off. He did not tell stories anymore, had not told one since he and Abdullah had returned from Kabul. Maybe, Abdullah thought, father had sold the Wahdadis, his muse as well. Gone, vanished, nothing left, nothing said. Other than these words from Parvana. It had to be her. I'm sorry, Abdullah. She had to be the one. The finger cut to save the hand. He knelt on the ground behind the windmill, at the base of the decaying stone tower. He took off his gloves and dug at the ground. He thought of her heavy eyebrows and her wide, rounded forehead, her gap-toothed smile. He heard in his head the tinkle of her laughter rolling around the house like it used to. He thought of the scuffle that had broken out when they had come back from the bazaar. Pari panicking, shrieking. Uncle Nabi quickly whisking her away. Abdullah dug until his fingers struck metal. Then he maneuvered his hands underneath and lifted the tin tea box from the hole. He swiped cold dirt off the lid. Lately, he thought a lot about the story father had told them the night before the trip to Kabul. The old peasant, Baba Ayub, and the Deev. Abdullah would find himself on a spot where Pari had once stood, her absence like a smell pushing up from the earth beneath his feet, and his legs would buckle, and his heart would collapse in on itself, and he would long for a swig of the magic potion the Deev had given Baba Ayub, so he too could forget. But there was no forgetting. Pari hovered, unbidden, at the edge of Abdullah's vision everywhere he went. She was like the dust that clung to his shirt.
She was in the silences that had become so frequent at the house. Silences that welled up between their words.
Sometimes cold and hollow, sometimes pregnant with things that went unsaid,
like a cloud filled with rain that never fell. Some nights he dreamed that he was in the desert again, alone, surrounded by the mountains, and in the distance a single tiny glint of light flickering on, off, like a message. He opened the tea box. They were all there, Paris feathers shed from roosters, ducks, pigeons, the peacock feather too. He tossed the yellow feather into the box. One day, he thought, hoped. His days in Schottbach were numbered, like Shoja's. He knew this now. There was nothing left for him here. He had no home here. He would wait until winter passed and the spring thaw set in. And he would rise one morning before dawn, and he would step out the door. He would choose a direction, and he would begin to walk. He would walk as far from Schottbach as his feet would take him. And if one day, trekking across some vast open field, despair should take hold of him, he would stop in his tracks and shut his eyes, and he would think of the falcon feather Perry had found in the desert. He would picture the feather coming loose from the bird, up in the clouds, half a mile above the world, twirling and spinning in violent currents, hurled by gusts of blustering wind across miles and miles of desert and mountains to finally land, of all places and against all odds, at the foot of that one boulder for his sister to find. It would strike him with wonder then, and hope too, that such things happened. And though he would know better, he would take heart and he would open his eyes and walk.